seated, please. The court is ready to hear argument in 03-1189 Daimler Chrysler Corporation v. Bill Inman.
May it please the court, Mr. Theodore Boutros will give an argument to the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, this is an appeal from an order certifying a nationwide product liability class action, alleging breach of warranty and seeking billions of dollars based on a theory that the seatbelt buckles in certain Daimler Chrysler vehicles might someday in the future malfunction and fail to restrain passengers due to a supposedly defective design. Although the Court of Appeals set aside the certification order and remanded for a further review of choice of law issues, Daimler Chrysler was still aggrieved because it did not receive the maximum relief to which it is entitled and which it sought below. We contend in particular that the class should have been decertified and the case dismissed because the class representatives lack standing to sue. Their vehicles have operated in the real world for many years, precisely as warranted and intended.
We're talking about a legal question, whether someone can recover for unmanifested defects.
Yes, Your Honor.
And how can we answer that question without knowing what law applies?
Well, Your Honor, I think with respect to the standing question, that is a question of Texas law.
Okay, but I mean, my understanding is the trial court is going to now parse through the conflict of laws issues. We have said that in Compact that that is sort of an unresolved question in our courts of appeals. Don't we have to see how the trial court's going to break down the choice of law issues and decide what law it's going to apply before we can review that?
No, Your Honor. The standing question, the question of whether the named plaintiffs have suffered a concrete, particularized injury that would allow them to step into the Texas courts is a Texas law question. So the question of cognizable injury is a question of standing under Texas law. And under that test, the plaintiffs don't meet it. They have not suffered the kind of concrete actual injury. And it flows from the Texas Constitution and the open courts provision.
But what if, I mean, it's a nationwide class, or was. There is no class now. So how is a Texas court to decide the California purported class members? What law applies?
We do think that on the choice of law issues as well, that the court should simply decertify the class and not remand it. But putting that aside, Your Honor, again, these plaintiffs purport to be representing not people from California, that's one of the two states omitted, but they purport to be representing 10 million people from all over the country. Before they can come into court to do that, they have to prove that they have standing under Texas law. So the court doesn't need to consider anyone else except those plaintiffs.
But you're not saying Texas would apply Texas law to a New York purported class member's claim?
No, it would not, Your Honor, but the whoever comes into the Texas courts must meet the Texas standing requirements. These plaintiffs are here seeking to come into Texas court.
But
this
I guess what I'm saying is we're kind of talking around each other a little bit. Of course they have to meet the Texas standing requirement. But to make that determination, you have to look at what state's law on unmanifested defects.
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. That with respect to the injury inquiry, this court must determine whether an unmanifested defect, where the plaintiffs have driven their cars for a combined 25 years.
Under which law?
Under Texas law, whether that's an injury in fact.
But what
Texas
about
law.
Purported class members who are not from Texas?
The court need not concern with those class members at this point because we're concerned with whether these plaintiffs have suffered and have been aggrieved by a wrong that caused them an injury sufficient to allow them standing in the Texas courts. So the court need not look at the choice of law questions. This is a Texas law question under the Constitution and under the separation of powers doctrine in Texas. And the question in this court's cases, in the MD Anderson case and the Grizzle case, have made clear that a plaintiff who seeks to carry a case for a whole group of people must show that they have suffered the cognizable injury that gives them the right to sue.
In this case, if I understand it, the plaintiffs have pled economic injury. If there is a manifest defect in the sense that these seatbelt buckles unbuckle, that's not what they bought. That's not what they thought they were buying. It was a warranty question. claiming an economic loss because the product is not what was represented. Why isn't that an injury that's been pled, which would support standing?
Well, actually, Your Honor, they have not pled an economic injury. They've pled and asked for cost of repair damages, but they skipped over the injury inquiry. They haven't shown that they have suffered a loss. Two of the plaintiffs, Mr. Wilkins and Mr. Castro, have never had their seatbelt release under any circumstance. One of them, Mr. Wilkins, drove his vehicle for 10 years, had no incident, it was an accident, and he was restrained by seatbelts. They had no problems with it. And they have jumped over, skipped over the injury inquiry and asked for cost of repair damages. Mr. Inman had two incidents over about an 8-year period, which he vaguely remembers, but neither of them were accidental release and an accident. So they have not pled the kind of injury that is required under Texas law.
So they clearly have pled breach of warranty.
They have alleged breach of warranty, yes.
Right. Okay. So, but you're just saying that they've alleged the wrong injury as a consequence of the breach of warranty, thereby cutting off their standing claim.
That's correct, Your Honor. They have not identified a type of injury recognized under Texas law that suffices to show the kind of concrete injury in fact that's required for standing. Their claims of defect are really completely disconnected from themselves. They argue, for example, their main argument is that the door jam sticker on the vehicle said that the vehicle complied with federal safety standards.
How likely could it be that a defect was going to manifest but hadn't yet, and there be the kind of injury that you think these causes of action require?
All right, I think likelihood or risk, again, get us into that territory of no injury. There are instances, and I'll admit this, where someone who hasn't suffered personal injury may still be able to bring a case for breach of warranty. If they had thought they were buying a different bucket that functioned differently, but they and paid more but got a different the Gen 3 buckle instead, that would be a different situation. Or if they had had problems and gone out and gotten their vehicle fixed and spent money. But the mere risk, I think this court's decisions in the sort of the fear of injury area make this clear. And in our system of justice, we wait until some sort of tangible, concrete injury is suffered. There are other remedies if there is a risk, Your Honor, of injury. And Texas Attorney General, the NHTSA.
What about cases like the famous Ford Pinto case, or most recently these tire cases that allegedly caused rollovers? The injury hasn't, in those cases, didn't necessarily manifest before something was done, perhaps exception of that Ford Pinto case. Once they knew there was a problem, that there was a potential for a defect or the product was defective, isn't that enough to suggest that there is reasonable that an injury could manifest at some later point date, just like in a toxic torque case, there's exposure to all of these, say, asbestos particles, and injury hasn't manifested, but based on some science, there's enough science to conclude that at some point in the future there'll be a manifestation of perhaps a mesothelioma, and those plaintiffs are compensated.
Your Honor, under product liability law, generally there must be an injury. The product must malfunction and cause personal injury, property damage, or some economic loss. With a vehicle, if someone has their vehicle, like Mr. Wilkins, for example, for 10 years, and it functions perfectly well, no problems, that stretches the concept of injury beyond the realm of anything that this court and most courts in the country have held. But there is a remedy, Your Honor. I think you're getting at a point, you know, what do we do if there's a safety problem and people have not actually been injured? The remedy is, one, in an automobile context, to go to the Federal Highway Safety Administration, there can be a recall. That can, and in Texas, under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, the Attorney General can file an action, can get an injunction precluding the sale or requiring actions to be taken. The Motor Vehicle Board can enforce the Motor Vehicle Code to enforce an express warranty. So consumers are not left unprotected, and it takes me back to the separation of powers point. That really falls in the realm of these agencies.
What if we were to decide that this really isn't a standing issue, that it's more of a look at the merits? And if we were to decide that, how far could or should this court go in class actions in looking at the merits so that we don't spend a lot of resources
getting essentially frivolous claims.
Your Honor, I think that the court in this class action area where we're talking about individuals who are going to be proceeding through the whole court system with this huge case, that it is appropriate, at least with respect to them, and it does collapse back to the standing issue to a certain point on injury. But I think the court could say these plaintiffs have no valid claim. And some of the standing cases talk about this, the Grizzle case, where the court said a plaintiff to bring a class action must have a valid claim. If they don't have a valid claim, they cannot be the individuals who stand in court on behalf of others. So I think there is authority for that. The court wouldn't be deciding the merits of other people not before the court in that context. It would only be deciding whether these plaintiffs can bring a claim. And I believe the State Farm v. Lopez decision, the court at least held up the possibility there that if the record was such that the court could make a determination on the merits in the class certification stage, it could do so.
But I think we're one of the first courts to have said that. I mean, how far should we go in looking at the merits before we allow trial courts to certify classes?
Your Honor, I believe if the focus is on whether the plaintiffs have a valid claim and whether they have been injured, and that's probably as far as the court needs to go here, whether they have a viable legal claim, that would be appropriate. And in the federal system, for example, the Rivera court cited the Rivera decision in the Fifth Circuit applying Texas law. It held this isn't a viable claim for warranty or product liability and found no standing. That's how that court reached the question. So I think that's an appropriate framework to do it. But I think that in this context, it is appropriate to look at whether the plaintiffs have a valid claim. But I think it ties back into the standing.
In your view, what's the minimum that has to happen for there to be an injury in fact?
I think there are several possibilities. One would be if the plaintiffs, as I said, thought they were buying one product. Here, say they bargained for the Gen 4, the later model seatbelt buckle, paid more, and it turned out they got the what they claim would be the less valuable buckle. That function in their claim
That is their claim, though, isn't it?
I mean, no, it's not.
Well, but I mean, their claim is not by that name, but their claim is we bargained for a seatbelt that met federal safety standards and we got one that didn't.
Their claim is really that they wish the product was different and functioned better, like the court said in General Motors Corp. v. Brewer was not a breach of warranty. But what they claim is that they bought a vehicle that had these Gen 3 seatbelt buckles and that there's a sticker that claims it complies with the federal safety standards. But they don't say that they looked at that sticker. They don't say that they relied on it.
Confining the topic only to the Gen 3 buckles.
Yes.
What at a minimum has to happen, in your opinion, for there to be an injury in fact?
At a minimum, Your Honor, the plaintiffs would have either had to have expended money to fix the seatbelt, or if they had resold their vehicles and could prove that they had gotten less money because the purchaser said, I don't like this seatbelt, it doesn't look like it's as good as the one I want, and paid less. Or another possibility would be that if they had actually experienced problems, that they had been in an accident and the seatbelt had not functioned as intended in an accident, and it had rendered it unusable, for example. If they could come forward with concrete proof that.
So what if this case had been for injunctive relief, to ask that your client replace all of these buckles, would we be in a different posture?
In that circumstance, I think we'd have a preemption problem and an intrusion on the federal agency, NHTSA's authority to recall vehicles. So I think that would create a different problem. But there are ample remedies for consumers. Under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, plaintiff can get attorney's fees if they have a problem, if they have suffered some concrete injury, some wisp of injury. These plaintiffs were perfectly happy with their vehicles until they were recruited, literally in some cases, off the street.
Well, they were happy until they knew that there was a potential for a problem. I mean, I don't read everything about a vehicle that I drive, and I know that the seatbelt on the passenger side doesn't retract like it should.
That's the first thing you think about when you have kids in the back seat, you know. If you hear that the seatbelt is not going to work, you don't want to drive that car anymore. Isn't that true?
Your Honor, I think that it is very important. Seatbelts are a very important feature of the vehicle. They need to be thought of in context of the entire restraint system. But as I said, there are things that could be done. The plaintiffs with all respect to their position in this case, if they had felt so strongly about this, then when they learned of this, they would have fixed the seatbelt or done something. If it really was the kind of imminent danger that they claim, but instead they've driven their vehicles and operated in the exact same manner. And I'm not at all minimizing the importance of safety and seatbelts. I think it's very important, but there are ways to address this problem.
Let's assume that at your home you become aware that the step leading to your front door is defective. It hadn't broken. Nobody's been injured yet. But every day, you know that you and your kids and your wife are stepping on that defective step every day, several times, in order to go into or come out of your house. Do you have a remedy? Are you injured? Or do you have to wait till something happens?
First, Your Honor,
or is that a different situation than what we're faced with today?
I think it's different, Your Honor, first. But I would fix it. I would fix it if I truly thought it was a concrete problem, an injury. I would get it fixed.
But that what,
and then you have a lawsuit for the repair.
I would try to recover my money. No, Your Honor, that's not what they want. They haven't fixed it. They continue to drive it.
But they want the cost to fix it. What if you can't afford to fix your step? Can you not recover to... get the money to fix your... I mean, it strikes me that's exactly what they're asking for.
If under Justice Wainwright's hypothetical, if they had experienced problems, as I said, if the seatbelt had been causing them difficulties that made it unusable or created difficulties for them and interfered with the operation of the vehicle, or in Justice's hypothetical, the house, you can't
now,
get into your house, that's not what's
Mr.
happening.
Inman has. Now, you dispute... the circumstances under which that occurred, but he has alleged my seatbelt did not latch properly.
He alleged two incidents. One, that he thinks he may have not latched it properly in the first place and it came loose in 1997.
No, but again,
yes.
I mean, these are fact issues.
Yeah, no, I'm accepting, I'm not disputing what he said for these purposes. And he also says that he hit his seatbelt with a beverage cooler and it unlatched.
So he has had injury because it hasn't worked as it was promised.
That's not injury, Your Honor, and that's not the kind of accidental release that is discussed in the regulations. There's a letter that we've cited on page 15, I believe, of our brief from the NHTSA chief counsel that said that the accidental release that is discussed there is accidental release in an accident, and that's not what happened here. And so that does not qualify as the type of injury that reduces the value. And just finally, the plaintiffs haven't argued diminished value or loss of bargain. They've only asked for loss, cost of repairs. My time is up, and I will sit down. Thank you.
Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. William Edward Stern will present argument for the respondents.
Good morning. May it please the court. I want to get off of my outline just a little bit and pick up where the discussion just left off. It was very interesting what I heard Diamond Chrysler say, what in fact, or what is injury in fact. If they had expended money to fix it, at tab 9 of our brief, Mr. Inman's affidavit says that he took his car to the dealership and tried to get his buckles replaced, and they told him they wouldn't do it. Diamond Chrysler also said that if they had actually experienced problems, and has already pointed out, Mr. Inman in that same affidavit and in his testimony explains how his buckle has come unlatched. And if it comes unlatched from simply opening up an ice chest and the lid bumping it, it goes right along with the history of these buckles, unlatching due to elbows from crash chest dummies hitting it, from people hitting it with their elbows, from car child safety seats.
Looks like if it were that bad, an agency would recall it.
That may be, but that's not a question that has to be answered to determine whether or not Bill Inman has standing. Donald Chrysler also...
Well, the problem that in these kinds of cases is that we're about to have a massive piece of litigation, and we don't know whether anybody cares outside the courtroom. We don't know whether any of these drivers care. We don't know whether... they would spend so much as $3 to get this terrible problem fixed. Is there just no way to know whether this really is serious or something that's just been ginned up by counsel?
Well, I would suggest first that it is serious. There are some 30 cases involving serious injury and death that have been filed.
Why hasn't there been a recall by NHTSA?
You know, that's a question for to ask of NHTSA, and I can't answer that. I do know that the former general counsel for NHTSA is now representing Diamond Chrysler in Gen 3 class actions. And I also know that the current general counsel for NHTSA came from the general counsel's office of Diamond Chrysler. Unfortunately, Bill Inman doesn't have anybody like that to speak for him at NHTSA.
Okay, then why does he have standing?
That question has to do, that question is directed to NHTSA, and it certainly should not influence whether or not Bill Inman has standing to bring his cause of action. Diamond Chrysler said that this is an appeal from a class order involving billions of dollars. In fact, from Bill Inman's perspective, this case is now his individual claim. This is Bill Inman's case, because the Court of Appeals already did away with the class order. There is no class order at this point. There is none. Bill Inman stands in this court by himself with the other two plaintiffs, not as a class representative anymore, because there is no class order.
He is the United States Supreme Court wrestled with this in some other contexts, but in the Asbestos Metro North case, whatever it was, they say, well, if you've just been if you've just been exposed to asbestos, and there is some possibility that you'll develop cancer, but it's not a high possibility, it's there, you have to wait until the cancer manifests itself. You can't use the exposure as a basis for the action for the cancer.
Yes.
And why isn't that sort of like this?
Oh, it's a perfect example. You see, if I go out and I buy some asbestos product and I use it myself and I get exposed to it and then I learn, oh my gosh, it might cause me cancer, I know that I can't bring a case and say, I'm afraid that you have caused me cancer with your product. On the other hand, if I go out and I buy an asbestos-containing product and I'm going to give it to my employees to use, for instance, and then I find that this product may cause my employees cancer and that it's defective because it doesn't pass without objection in the industry or it doesn't conform with the label on the product that says that it doesn't contain asbestos, do I not then have an injury for receiving something that I didn't want, that I didn't buy, that was not part of my bargain? Can't I take it back then to the seller and say, look, you sold me something that was not represented as it, or is not as it was represented. Now, it hadn't caused me or any of my employees personal injury, but if we use it, it might.
Why didn't you seek injunctive relief?
You know, that's a very good question, and I expect that when we go back, we will seek having been through this process and seeing just being more exposed to it, I think that the UCC allows for specific performance, for instance. And I don't see any problem with going back and requesting specific performance, especially in light of the fact that Bill Inman tried to go and get his buckle replaced and was told that he could not.
But
and
the
in
concern
fact,
is...
And also since then, Chrysler has since quit making cars with Gen 3 buckles and are putting Gen 4 buckles in all of these vehicles, so the Gen 4 buckles are available, and it's much easier to ask for specific performance.
But the concern is that as products are always being developed, and some of them will work better than what you've got, and we had that in the Brewer case, how do you distinguish between that situation and a situation like this? That, you know, this works, you say it doesn't minimize accidental release. Well, it minimizes it to an extent. Just the question is, How far?
Well, in many of these other products cases, especially like the Bronco 2 cases and the Suzuki cases, the rollover type cases, the airbag cases, in most of those cases, there was no allegation that those vehicles or those component parts would not pass without objection in the industry, that they did not fail to conform with labeling on the product. In this instance, it was from the beginning. Chrysler identified the safety test for which they were going to design these buckles. First of all, they threw out the 30-millimeter ball test. We know that. But then they said the criteria, and this is the testimony from Diamond Chrysler engineers. I'm not making this up. They said the criteria that we were going to use on this, on the Gen 3 buckle, was a 40-millimeter ball test, and it doesn't pass the 40-millimeter ball test. So we're not talking about them learning somewhere down the road that the Gen 3 buckle could be made safer. They knew it when they made it. They also knew it when Allied Signal wrote them a letter and said, you're rushing into this program, you're moving way too fast. If we're going to do it, we will make this buckle for you out of customer satisfaction, you being our customer, but you're going to have to hold us harmless for the risk that comes from this. And I think it's important now that I back up just a moment. We've been talking an awful lot about injury. And I want to emphasize that when it comes to a jurisdictional standing analysis, that particularized injury has a very distinct meaning in the jurisprudence of this state and in the federal courts as well. Particularized injury goes to the proposition of whether or not an individual as a plaintiff has some form of grievance different than the general public. For instance, in the MD Anderson case, Mr. Novak could not show that he had some injury, some particularized injury different than the general public. He, even though he had received the letter, he had spent no money. He had sent no money. That was in the he was in the same shoes as anybody in the general public that says, you know, they shouldn't have sent that type of letter out, and I'm going to sue them because they shouldn't have done it. But our courts don't allow that because they don't have a particularized injury different from the general public. And in fact, in the Polaris case out of Tyler, the recent watercraft case, they cite to they quote a list of things that show standing. They have sustained some direct injury as a result of a wrongful act. There is a direct relationship between their alleged injury and the claim sought to be adjudicated. They have a personal stake in the controversy. This is interesting. The challenged action has caused them an injury in fact, whether economic, recreational, environmental, or otherwise. I don't know exactly what a recreational injury is, but I'm not aware of any remedy for it. But in that instance, it's saying we're not talking about whether or not you have a remedy for it. We're not talking about whether or not you meet the elements of a particular cause of action. We're talking about something else. And if you go back on the history of that quote, you end up at a court of appeals decision from Corpus Christi in 1976. At least that's how far I took it back. And they were talking about particularized injury, and they were talking about concrete injury, and they were talking about these factors. And that case involved tenants suing a housing authority for illegal expenditures that the people who ran the housing authority shouldn't be making. And the court's analysis in that case applied these factors and said these tenants do have standing because if that money wasn't spent on paying these commissioners money that they shouldn't be paid, then perhaps the rents would be lower. Perhaps that money could have been spent on the housing units themselves and made them better. And that was enough injury for those tenants to have standing. But none of those tenants said, we're here under a UCC claim seeking compensation. None of them said we're here on a negligence claim. None of them were saying, give us money. But the court in that case, the appellate court, analyzed injury in that context. And they cited U.S. Supreme Court cases, and the U.S. Supreme Court does the same thing. Injury in the jurisdictional standing setting is not the same as injury, for instance, that you must have to bring a product liability case.
What is your position in this case on whether the car has less value because of the seatbelt?
I think with people who know about the seatbelt buckle, that it has less value. And you know, that's an interesting point, because to say that there is no injury in this case is to say that a defective safety device has as much economic value as a non-defective safety device. Well, and I just don't see how that doesn't ring true.
Well, the argument is you're not asking for damages for reduction in value because you can't prove it. All you're asking for is cost of repair. So I'm interested in your response to that.
Well, you know, Nobility Homes, which is an interesting case that seems to not be talked about in any case that purports to apply Texas law in a breach of implied warranty case where they, and I'm thinking in particular N. Ray Airbags and Martin B. Ford, both of those federal district courts purported to apply Texas law and poured out some plaintiffs on an implied warranty basis without talking about Nobility Homes. This court decided Nobility Homes in 1976. And the question there was whether or not a person could recover economic loss, that is, loss of the value within the value of the product itself, no harm to other property, no physical harm. Can that type of loss be recovered under various causes of action? And the, Justice Pope wrote the opinion and said in a 402A products liability case, you can't recover it. But in an implied warranty, breach of warranty case, you can. And in a footnote, he describes the difference between economic loss and consequential loss. And economic loss is a loss of value, if you will, of the product itself.
Just
and
a general,
he said that one of the things, excuse me, just real quick, one of the things, that one measure of that damage is cost of repair. It can be, one measure can be the actual, you know, you compare the value with and without. But another measure is cost of repair. And
that, that was going to be my question. Does the general rule of you get the lesser of the two apply here? I mean, generally
actually,
speaking,
there's an earlier opinion of this court that says you can get the greater of the two. But whether you're talking lesser or greater, you're entitled to plead and try to prove.
Well, usually, I thought historically the rule on repair had been you can't get the cost of repair if it exceeds the decrease in market value.
That's that part of it, yes. I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
So would you have to, if decrease in market value is zero, why would you be entitled to any damages? If that's a cap on...
I'm sorry.
In other words,
I thought maybe I understood your question correctly the first time because...
I thought historically you have to show that the cost of repair is not greater than the diminution in market value. It's, you know, it's a typical car accident case. I get have a fender bender, and generally the measure of damages is the cost of repair, but not if it exceeds the diminution in market value.
No, I think it's not if it exceeds the value of the product itself.
I thought it was diminution in value.
No, because if I drive a junk car and somebody hits it and makes it a little more junk, I'm still entitled to have that dent pulled out if it's a dent that I don't want. Even if it's arguably...
Maybe under insurance, but I'm not sure that's true under general...
I'm not aware of any case that puts that kind of a cap on those damages. Certainly under Nobility Homes, this court wrote that cost of repair is a proper measure of damages for economic loss. There was... Let's see. I do want to touch upon this. In our implied warranty allegations, we don't limit our allegation to not fit for its ordinary purpose, which is what many of the other so-called no injury cases that Diamond Chrysler cites do. There are other parts to 2.314. The first part is pass without objection in the trade. The last one is conform to the promises or affirmations of fact made on the container or label. And we say that in this instance, this vehicle does not pass without objection in the trade because it does not meet the industry standards, the industry customs in terms of the testing that other companies use. Other companies, the record demonstrates that Ford and GM both used ball test and that they would not put this buckle in their cars because it doesn't meet their requirements. There is also evidence that it does not comply with the NHTSA standard, which requires that seatbelt buckles minimize the possibility of accidental release. So we're saying not just that they are unfit for their ordinary purpose, but they don't pass without objection in the trade. Also, they don't conform to the affirmations of fact made on the label. In this particular case, there is a label on the car that says it complies with all federal motor vehicle safety standards. The allegations are, the evidence is, and kind of basically back to what I was saying a minute ago about why we're here, because
Time's running out. Let me ask, why is this going to be an advisory opinion? If the court's opinion below was remand, but do some more work on it, and the result in this case was to be to end it, why would that be advisory?
For this court to write, are you asking why any opinion?
If we were to disagree, obviously, if we agree with you, this is an open question, you've alleged standing, no change in anything. But if we were to rule the other way, you say it would be, in your brief, it would be advisory to do that because it's already been, class action's been busted, it's been remanded. The problem with these interlocutory appeals is that can go on for years. Well, we want a trial plan to go back. Okay, well, this time we want a choice of law. Wouldn't it be better to do all of these class action questions on the first interlocutory appeal?
Well, I think that first and foremost that it is imperative to our system that we stay within the boundaries of the written law and the written rules.
I couldn't agree more.
And
but
the written rules say
you'd agree with me. It makes no sense to if a defendant comes up and says no trial plan, no choice of law analysis, for us to answer one and then send it back, and then we'll take up the other one next time. You should go ahead and say there's two problems here, not just one.
Perhaps, but I'll tell you, this court did exactly that in Compaq Computer versus Lafray.
Oh, a lot of courts have done it. I don't disagree with that. But we're starting to get the second and third round now, and we're starting to think whether we should keep doing it that way on these interlocutory appeals.
There's a very good reason for doing it in this case. First of all, as this court pointed out in Compaq v. Lafray, some of the other issues that this court addressed in its opinion and saying that needed to be addressed in the courts below had not been developed in the courts below, and let's send it back and let these things come back up the way they should so that we get input, we get involvement from the lower courts, from the parties, and from trial court and from the appellate courts, which is a very good idea. You know, the jurisdictional statutes that allow jurisdiction in this court that we are allegedly here on, it's supposed to be an appeal or a petition for review for the appeal of an interlocutory certification order. And there is no such order anymore. There simply is no such order. And we would...
But you're not giving up trying to get one.
We're not here on our petition for review.
I know, but you're not going to go... When you go back to the trial court, you're going to try again.
Not necessarily. I mean, it's... I tell you what, based on what I've read, I doubt that...
I'll concede. If you stipulate you don't want a class action anymore, this case is probably moot up here. You're not stipulating
that. I'm not going to stipulate to that in its entirety, but in its current posture in this court, this is only Bill Inman's individual case. There is no class action here because there is no class action.
Thank you, Joe.
Let me just start with the Bill Inman issue. Mr. Inman testified at his deposition when asked, what kind of damage do you claim you have sustained personally? He said, none to this point. And then again he was asked, what damages are you seeking for yourself in this case? And he said, none. I don't know how that can possibly give him standing.
But again, it's difficult for me to understand this as an issue of standing as we've recognized that concept. And let's take Boyles versus Kerr, negligent infliction of emotional distress. No one disputed that the plaintiff there had experienced emotional distress. We just said there's no remedy for it. But we didn't decide it as a matter of standing. She had standing to assert that she had been damaged. It's just the law didn't recognize a remedy for it. And so I'm having a hard time getting my arms around this threshold standing issue.
Your Honor, I think here it comes together because their claim is defective as a matter of law because they have suffered no legally cognizable injury, which is the test for standing.
Same in Boyles versus Kerr, but we didn't term that a standing question.
It probably, because the court is looking at it in the class action context, and because the court has said that standing is a fundamental prerequisite, this court and the federal courts do the same thing. They look at it as a standing issue. The Rivera court under the federal Article III standing principles did the same thing and said, we must determine whether this person has the right to be in court. And so it's treated as a standing issue, and it's crucial to determine that.
But you'd agree we've never treated it as a standing issue.
In the MD Anderson case, I believe the court did treat it as a standing issue.
Well, but
I mean, that just strikes me as a different situation, because there, I mean, there had been no injury in a different sense. I mean, here you've got a plaintiff with what they're claiming are defective goods. Now, whether it's ripened yet into an injury, that may be another question, but to say that the failure for the law to afford a remedy at this point prevents you from having standing just seems to be something we've never gone that far before. Else, how do you avoid looking at the merits of every case and say if a case is meritless, there's no standing?
This is, I think, a unique situation. Plaintiffs have suffered no injury, but they want to bring this claim. And let me give you an example, Justice O'Neill, with the MD Anderson case. There the court found that because even though there were maybe false statements made, that plaintiff had not been defrauded. Therefore, that plaintiff could not bring a class action. In this case, plaintiffs rely on this door jam sticker that refers to the NHTSA standards. But they don't claim that they ever saw it, that they relied on it, so they weren't injured by it. It's exactly like the MD Anderson situation. Maybe someone out there in the world can say they relied on that sticker and they were injured by it, but these are not the right plaintiffs to bring that claim. It's a classic standing issue.
But we've never addressed failure to establish reliance on standing.
In the MD Anderson case, that was built right into the case. The court said you must show reliance on fraud. Plaintiff in that case said that he wasn't going to show reliance, and the court held he hadn't been injured because he didn't show reliance, and therefore he didn't have standing, and he couldn't bring a class action. So it's exactly the situation we have here. And just to go back to the point on the NHTSA standards, the notion that this vehicle doesn't comply with the NHTSA standards is false. NHTSA has looked at this issue for many years. These vehicles have been on the road for 10 years. And the agency, which enforces its own regulations, has rejected, by not finding or recalling these vehicles, the argument that the vehicles don't comply. There's no dispute that the vehicles comply with those standards built into the regulation. The other point I wanted to make, just going back to the cost of repair issue, the plaintiffs, not in their live petition, not in their brief in this court, not in any of their briefs in the lower court, have ever argued that the vehicle was worth less because it had this seatbelt. They have jumped over it and asked for the cost of repair. They have not shown that there's an injury. In Mobility Homes, I'm not sure why the plaintiff cited in support of them. I think it supports us. It says cost of repair is a measure of injury. Plaintiffs haven't shown injury. Therefore, they have no standing and are asking to alter the law to get it. We ask you to reject that argument. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. This cause is submitted, and the court will take another brief recess.
All rise.